Welcome to the Chrisman Commentary Daily Mortgage News Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Chrisman. Topics on today's episode include home buying challenges across genders, an excerpt of an interview from yesterday's Mortgage Matters show with Sterling Point Advisors Jeff Julianne and Brett Ludden on the M&A space and how to value mortgage companies. And it's pretty quiet out there in the capital markets, but we have received first quarter GDP. Thanks to today's podcast sponsor, Calc. Given that rates are the highest they've been in decades, how can homeowners be convinced to move into a new home? With the trade and mortgage powered by Calc, homeowners can buy before they sell, make non-contingent offers, and tap their home equity to fund the down payment on their next home. The result? Lenders help their clients negotiate a lower purchase price, reduce their interest payments, and eliminate PMI. Do you know that men and women cite different challenges when purchasing a home? 55% of females say that their biggest challenge when buying a home as a single individual was finding a home in their price range. But 51% of males said that their biggest challenge was saving up for a down payment. There are some similarities, though. Over half of respondents believe the idea of waiting for a significant other to buy a home is outdated. And 2/3 of single home buyers did not have financial assistance from family or friends with a down payment for their home. Interesting. Speaking of affordability, mortgage rates have risen to their highest level in 5 months, impacting borrower costs for potential homebuyers. There's not much else out there to report, but we did learn yesterday that the durable orders report for March surpassed expectations with the actual figure at 2.6%, compared to the consensus of 1.8%. Despite the positive durable goods outcome, the report showed signs of ongoing hesitancy in demand, particularly in shipments data, which remained weak. The volatility in aircraft-related orders contributed to the overall increase, but also highlighted underlying uncertainties. For today's interview, I wanted to play for you an excerpt of yesterday's Mortgage Matters show with Sterling Point Advisors Jeff Julianne and Brett Ludden on the M&A space and how to value mortgage companies. Sterling Point Advisors is primarily involved in M&A activity.
I think we want to talk M&A for a good chunk of today's show. But I'd like to start, and we were talking offline a little bit. You're out there talking to a lot of lenders. What's kind of the overall chatter or mood right now?
A little bit of a sense of optimism. I've heard of several lenders who said that March originations were their best month of originations in 2 years, independent of calendar. That came as a little bit of a surprise to us, because when you look at MBA applications, purchase applications are down year over year. Refinance, while up a little bit, is still pretty much in the gutter. So the fact that they did better than they've done in the past tells me that there's probably been a fair amount of consolidation that is kind of going under the radar. But at the end of the day, I think that's going to be short-lived, because most of these guys are talking about what happened right before rates took back off over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, Robbie, to piggyback off of that a little bit, I think the industry as a whole believed we were going to be in a short end of the curve rate easing cycle in 2024, which they hoped kind of pushed the long end down and get to kind of more historical primary, secondary spread, et cetera. And, you know, obviously with the last three PPI, CPIs, and obviously PCE comes out later this week, and that'll be a big number right after some of the big tech earnings that come out tomorrow night. And so I think those hopes have been dashed. We saw where there was a market was anticipating 7 easings into this year. I think the Fed itself was at 4 easings. And now basically both of those things have kind of asymptotically got to the same point about at now there's 1 to 2 and they're backloaded in the year. So obviously mortgage rates have a 7 handle on them now. So I think a lot of that optimism has been dashed, and, you know, we'll see how things play out. But, we do a semi-annual economic outlook that we do in conjunction with Lenders One as well, which is obviously a great thing to get our brand and that information out to the members. You know, we're redoing it right now. And it's a tricky story of basically where we thought we were going to, where we're going to get to this year versus where we're actually going to get to. And it's not conducive to a better mortgage environment.
Brett, when you say M&A is flying under the radar, aren't you the radar? How's it flying under your radar? Aren't you in this knee deep every day?
certainly, I think M&A flies under the radar. In some cases, people don't announce what they're doing. I think there's a variety of different types of consolidation that may not even be M&A that are happening. You're seeing loan originators who are just retiring. You're seeing some companies that are just choosing to shut down as opposed to consolidate. Some of the smaller lenders are becoming brokers. So you're kind of seeing a flow away from lender to brokerage. All of those things really represent that consolidation. But absolutely on the M&A side, there's not as much celebration of deals. And that's unfortunate because across the entire rest of every other industry, an M&A deal is a celebration of something that somebody built and they're being paid to actually sell that business. And in M&A, sometimes it feels like owners are feeling like they lost. And from our perspective, that couldn't be further from the truth.
There's also a bifurcated market inside of the mortgage space where QM, there's certainly a different appetite from a QM perspective and kind of, for lack of a better way of saying it, a white hot interest inside of the non-QM space. And so, you know, we interact with a lot of private equity funds that are really looking to make a name inside of the non-QM space. And like none of them really have an appetite for QM at all. And so it's just really a very interesting market that we're sitting in right now.
Unfortunately, when people try to put the value that they're targeting at the peak of mortgage valuations, they're never going to live up to their own expectations, number one. And the idea that you want to outlast everybody else, unfortunately, everybody at the table that's gambling with you is saying the same thing and nobody's folding. And that's part of what's creating this challenge is that there's a supply and demand imbalance. There are a lot of groups that really need to acquire for growth. They're positioned to be buyers because they've got capital, they've got cash, they have experience with M&A, but they can't find willing partners. But listen, we get it because each day we're talking to owners and the amount of money that they make actually is not the number one consideration for doing a deal. Even if they're considering doing a deal, it's, am I going to take my team to a good place? Are they going to be taken care of? Do I see myself being able to be an employee for somebody else? Like those are the questions that are hardest for them to answer, not the question of how much money should I get paid. But like, don't get me wrong, at the end of the day, compensation is a critical element of getting any deal done.
You know, there's a very interesting dynamic, and I've seen it on both sides of the equation. One is when I worked at Capital One and Fannie Mae, and we were dealing with the street all the time, is like people made very rational decisions and they made the best economic decision relative to the PV outcome associated with option A versus option B. Inside of the IMB acquisition M&A space, it's like it is really a labor of love that these guys and girls have done inside their companies. And so the decision to walk away at what they believe is a trough valuation. And they, you know, Rob and Robbie, you know this better than anybody. I think these guys are and girls are eternal optimists. I think that's the gambler mentality you're talking about, Rob. And so the turn in the cycle is right around the corner. You know, we were projecting that 24 is going to be the year that we kind of saw the rebound, and the macro environment is just not setting up that way. And so I think it's really the fear of missing out of that next refi wave. And, you know, but that next refi way is never going to come again. I mean, I tell this story, and Rob, I know you experienced this. When I first got into mortgages, the fixed rate mortgage was 18%. We were in a 40-year refinancing wave. And every time there was a down cycle and a recession, the mortgage people made out like bandits on the other side of that because there was a decline in the 10-year. That just isn't going to happen now. So people need to wrap around in their minds the environment that we're in now and into the future, vis-a-vis the opportunities that people are putting in front of them. And it's really a difficult decision for these CEOs and owners to make. Simple as that.
Well, there are obviously a lot of qualitative factors that we've talked about. And Jeff, you used the word vacuum in your answer, which is ironic because I was going to ask, in a vacuum, how would it, like perfectly rational vacuum, how would a owner of an IMB act in this environment, whether it's servicing, whether it's selling the company? And that ties into a question we had in the chat from Tom. He asked if you've advised on deals, or when you advise on deals, do you find IMB owners overvalue their company?
Absolutely. And part of it's not their fault. some IMBs will go to generic valuation companies and ask for a valuation. And the way those generalist companies operate is that they look at trailing EBITDA from the past 5 years and they average it and then they multiply it by a factor, say a factor of three. And they say, you're probably worth average earnings of X million, three times EBITDA, you're worth $40 million. And that's the number that they have in their head. And they're like, I was told not to take anything less than that. The reality is that's not how to value a mortgage company. You got to value the mortgage company based on the expected cash flows in the future. These concepts of looking at EBITDA multiples and book multiples are good rules of thumb, but they don't actually represent the valuation. And that's unfortunate, but it's the reality that we see a lot. So it's not about looking back. It's about looking forward. That means we have to forecast gain on sale. We've got to forecast total production. We've got to forecast a single lender's contribution to that production relative to how competitive they were in the industry. And we can come up with expectations about their EBITDA for the next 5 years. And it's not certain. They've got to deliver on that. But it's a pretty grounded way of understanding, like, relative to what they have done in the past, what can we expect from them in the future? And that allows us to discount back to get to evaluation today.
And then when you have a value of a company of X, that doesn't mean that that's going to be what somebody pays for that company. There's then the structuring the transaction. And these transactions were always some upfront money that has obviously been getting lower and lower, and some are not associated with it. So at the end of the day, what we see and how we clear trades in this market is looking at, we come up with value of X, and then the present value of the payments through the earnout and the upfront cash equates to that theoretical value over a time. Period of time. And so that's aligning interests, because at the end of the day, the seller has to perform to get the earnout, which is gets them more to the value that was ascribed based on the valuation technique that Brett laid out. So there's two components to this. One is the absolute value, and then it's structuring a deal to align interests.
There's a really valuable component to being that division as opposed to being standalone, because your costs now become variabilized. If you don't originate, you're not going to have as much cost versus if you try to stand alone, you're going to have to eat all those fixed costs if things don't happen over the next year. As you grow, you're paying a variable rate for what you're doing. So you're going to be profitable more or less right off the bat once you ramp up. And there's no guarantee if you're standalone and you're going to eat those fixed costs on your own.
I would add a little tongue in cheek here. I was raised being told, what is the value of a mortgage company? The furniture at the office, especially if people leave when an M&A deal takes place. How do you take that into account?
We assume a breakage that we have observed in the marketplace over the deals that we've been involved in, which means that's the amount of LO volume that you're going to lose because of the actual activity of the acquisition occurring. And then also we use a discount rate that's basically looks at what the inspected implied cost of capital is for the transaction plus an uncertainty premium. So we use those two mechanisms to basically back into the price.
And if you were asking specifically about the furniture, Robbie?
Yeah. Do you include it?
So that we would book the $500 of computers and furniture, and then the rest of whatever's paid up front is going to be booked as goodwill. There's not a lot of assets actually being traded in an asset purchase.
I want to kind of meld what we've been talking about here. And Jeff, how do you get from the value you've assessed and what the owner thinks the company is worth to a proper middle ground that can actually get a deal done?
That's the art of deal making, Robbie. I mean, at the end of the day, whether we're on the buy side or sell side of the transaction, kind of, you know, we're just trying to, once you define the bid ask delta that we're dealing with, then you're trying to come up with theory/mechanisms for to be able to kind of meet in the middle at some level. And so we use a variety of those techniques. And so it's either more in the earnout or more upfront, or, you know, let's do some LO retention bonuses, nothing else upfront, and put more into the earnout. You know, there's a variety of different ways of getting there, but, you know, through the process, you understand the counterparties, you understand what motivates the counterparties, and you're able to kind of navigate or meld together a strategy that you know will work for those two counterparties. I know that's kind of a non-answer, Robbie, but that's really kind of the art versus the science of doing something.
I hear a lot of sellers or a lot of CEOs that say, look, these guys are loyal. I want to show my loyalty to them. I want to bring them under the tent. Do not do it. It's not in your interest to create uncertainty for people. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help you. It'll cause them to start looking for other opportunities, and it's going to limit the chances you're going to have to be able to retain them. So that's kind of rule number one. When you have to bring people under the tent and you do it right before you close, you have them sign NDAs so they can't immediately turn around and put it on LinkedIn so everybody finds out 3 days before close, before you have the signing event. But then on the other side, communication becomes so critical as soon as you announce. And we've seen deals that we weren't involved in where it appears that they didn't really think through communication strategies. But the reality is communication's everything to everybody. Once you announce a deal, like how are you going to onboard new team members? How are you going to make them feel comfortable with the new systems they've got to do? How are you going to help them get comfortable with new employment contracts? Being available, having people on the ground to meet with them and talk to them is so critical in those first couple of weeks. And it really drives the likelihood of retention. That is the number one factor, is how good of a job you do in working with those people.
So we had a question in the chat. Do MSR fees reasonably contribute to operating cash flow, assuming limited recapture? One of you take that question, and then the other one of you I would like to answer. I mean, you guys deal with repurchases. You do a quarterly review of the loan level repurchase activity for the GSEs. It's a consideration in M&A deals. What are we seeing there? So one of you on MSRs and one on repurchases.
And MSR, the answer is yes. The way we typically model them, it depends if the MSRs are in the deal or not in the deal. There's been deals that are done both ways where the buyer didn't have enough capital to take down the MSR portfolio, so we spin it off into an SPV or something like that. But the short answer to your question is typically how we do this is we fair value the MSRs as of the date of the trade. If they are getting acquired, and then we look at the gain on sale as if it was a released transaction. And so we don't explicitly forecast the MSR activity associated with that originator. We just say, we assume that it's either going to be cash gain or loss or non-cash gain or loss, and that fair value would be equal. And so at the end of the day, the short answer to your question is, yes, it contributes. It's a big part of the valuation, and we use that approach typically when we're valuing institutions.
So on the repurchase front, we're one of the only groups that looks at loan level repurchase data that comes out of Fannie and Freddie. They make it available on a quarterly basis. They will be providing their Q4 data in, I think, 3 or 4 days' time. And we absolutely have a good understanding of what's going on with repurchase rates over time. They do not factor nearly as heavily into valuations. You certainly hear if somebody's looking at doing a stock purchase where they're going to inherit the legacy liabilities of a company, there's going to be a lot more focus on repurchase. But the reality is repurchase, even though it's been bad recently, is not a major driver of value. The interesting thing, though, is that very few companies have grounded evaluation frameworks for their own rep and warranty reserves. Most of them just expense rep and warranty losses that they take in a quarter, as opposed to having a reserve that they built against it. Coming from a background where I built the reserves for, basically ran the reserves for Capital One's $100 billion of sales portfolio, it's been surprising to see the lack thereof in this industry. But at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal to an M&A transaction.
And if we're doing a stock deal, to be totally transparent, we typically handle the legacy liabilities through an indemnity.
I do kind of want to put a bow on what we've talked about today. And given the challenges in this current market, a lot of lenders are obviously struggling. It seems that very few are willing to engage in open conversations about potential M&A. It seems like good business practice to me for companies to do that almost once a year to assess value. How do we get more companies engaging in this without feeling like they're doing their employees wrong or rumors are going to be leaked or whatever it might be?
Well, I think that's a great question, because Brett and I have been kind of pushing this angle from day one we walked in the door here. So like, I think a strategic option of either acquisition, sell, or stay the course needs to be done on like a regular basis. And part of that starts and stops with understanding what a third party believes your value of your organization is And is that at that point in time worth exploring that kind of non-organic strategy that we've been talking about? So I do believe that that is a component that a lot of IMBs were caught with their pants down, and as we walked into this down cycle, I really do, Robbie. And so I think as they strategically plan, that should be part of the arsenal they have that they're thinking about.
Yeah, I'll add in that when you step just one step away from M&A itself, Robbie, companies should be doing more planning. What I'm used to is that you do scenario analysis where you have a variety of scenarios and you plan through what happens if rates go up, what happens if rates go down, what happens if we have a refi wave, what are we going to do? Like, do we have the cash? Do we have the people? If not, where are we going to get those things? What we see in this industry is at best, most companies have one scenario. They're hoping that scenario is going to be the scenario, and maybe they plan for it, maybe they haven't. What I hear pretty commonly is people don't really even have a plan. And what Jeff and I try to do, and I think we do an effective job of, is be educators first. The vast majority of companies we talk to, we never do deals with. They don't sell. They're not necessarily going to be buyers. We've talked to hundreds of companies, and we're here to educate them. So talking to them, we get an NDA in place. It's our job and it's our livelihood to make sure everything we say with them stays confidential. But at the end of the day, being educated is the smartest thing you can do in this type of environment.
The first look at Q1 gross domestic product kicked off today's calendar, up 1.6% annualized, low and truly slowing a deceleration for the economy. Real GDP growth was expected to slow to 2.5%, even with support from consumer and government spending. Jobless claims also out this morning are up 207,000. Later today, the U.S. Treasury will cap this week's note auction slate with a $44 billion 7-year note sale. Pending home sales for March will be released, as will Kansas City Fed manufacturing for April and Freddie Mac's primary mortgage market survey. We begin the day with agency MBS prices slightly worse than Wednesday evening, the 10-year yielding 4.69 after closing yesterday at 4.65%, and the 2-year yielding 4.97%. Let's wrap up with a joke and some housekeeping. She hurried to the pharmacy to get medication, got back to her car, and found that she had locked her keys inside. The woman found an old rusty coat hanger left on the ground. She looked at it and said, "I don't know how to use this." She bowed her head and asked God to send her some help. Within 5 minutes, a beat-up old motorcycle pulled up, driven by a bearded man who was wearing an old biker skull rag. He got off his cycle and asked if she needed help. She replied, "Yes. My daughter is sick. I've locked my keys in my car. I must get home. Please, can you use this hanger to unlock my car?" "Sure," he said. Walked over to the car, and in less than a minute, the car was open. She hugged the man and through tears said, "Thank you, God, for sending me such a very nice man." The biker heard her prayer and replied, "Lady, I'm not a nice man. I just got out of prison yesterday, and I was in prison for car theft." The woman hugged the man and sobbing said, "Oh, thank you, God. You even sent me a professional."
Thanks again to today's podcast sponsor, Calc. Given that rates are the highest they've been in decades, how can homeowners be convinced to move into a new home? With the trade mortgage powered by Calc, homeowners can buy before they sell, make non-contingent offers, and tap their home equity to fund the down payment on their next home. The result? Lenders help their clients negotiate a lower purchase price, reduce their interest payments, and eliminate PMI. If you have any questions about the podcast or sponsoring opportunities, send me an email at robbie@robchrisman.com. Visit robchrisman.com for more information on our industry partners, access to archived commentaries, and how to subscribe to the daily mortgage news and commentary. To listen to or download past episodes of this podcast, search Mortgage News on any platform you get your podcast from.